You're listening to the Golden West Podcast. I'm Ryan, your host. Join me as I explore the best in food and wine on the West Coast, including California, Oregon, and Washington. We're about to go on a journey, exploring the people and stories behind the vineyards, farms, and kitchens. So grab a drink, fire up your grill, pull up a seat to the table, and listen in. We'll talk about it coming up next. Today's show is brought to you by the hardcore wine dudes at First Bottle Wines. First Bottle is a sister site to the wildly popular one wine per day website Last Bottle Wines. First Bottle is based in Napa, California, and the team is well connected to hundreds of wineries, brokers, distributors, and importers all over the world, and they have spent decades building trust with them. Offering quality wines at unbeatable prices is their top priority. You'll see lots of big names on First Bottle. They've got older vintages, collectibles, and approachable daily drinkers from every major wine region. They taste over 50,000 wines a year and know how to pick a winner. So visit firstbottlewines.com and use promo code GOLDENWEST at checkout for 10% off your first purchase. That's promo code GOLDENWEST at firstbottlewines.com. Today's show is brought to you by Kova Coffee. Kova is a specialty roaster out of Portland, Oregon, and they're known for single-origin coffees, and they're committed to long-term, sustainable partnerships with coffee producers. Now, if you're like me, I love coffee. I always start my day off with a cup or two. I make it by hand with a pour-over, but it doesn't matter how you make yours. You can use a pour-over, maybe use a Chemex, maybe you just use a basic Mr. Coffee machine. It doesn't matter, but what does matter is the beans. You don't want those burnt, over-roasted corporate coffee beans that you find in the grocery store, and I don't even bother with that store brand stuff. So here's what you do. I'm going to make it really easy for you. Just go to kovacoffee.com, that's C-O-A-V-A-coffee.com, and use our promo code, GOLDENWEST. You'll get $5 off your first purchase. Do it now while you're thinking about it, and your coffee will show up at your doorstep as soon as you know it. Today on the show, we have Sarah Wetherich from Maggie Hawk. Enjoy my conversation with Sarah. Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ryan. Glad to be here.
It's great having you here. So before we get into the wines and talk about Maggie Hawk, we're going to be talking about mainly Pinot, but some other wines too, Chardonnay. Let's get into your background and how you first got into winemaking.
Right. So I went to UC Davis and eventually graduated with a degree in viticulture and enology. But heading into Davis, my major that I declared was atmospheric science. I had no idea that you could actually study and get a career in wine. I needed a few extra units the fall quarter of my freshman year. And my dad at the time was a home winemaker. And he said, well, you know, you're at the top school almost in the world for winemaking. Why don't you take an intro class? So I did, and I would say within the first half hour of Dr. Andy Waterhouse's class, Intro to Winemaking, I just like a light bulb went off over my head. I just fell in love. It was like, wow, this is incredible. It's science. It's plant biology. It's all of the things. And it just resonated with me immediately. So I changed my major right after that fall quarter of my freshman year and just haven't looked back. It was a lot of work. It was a lot of early mornings of labs when all of my friends got to sleep in and take, you know, the 10 to noon classes. So it was a lot of work: microbiology, physics, chemistry, biochemistry for the first couple years. And then starting in like sophomore, junior year, it was then getting into the practical winery and vineyard classes, which were amazing.
Wow. And your dad was making wine at home.
What grapes
was he using? And like, were you into wine at least a little bit? Like, were you like, oh, let me taste that? Or were you, like, what was your interest level and what type of wine was he making?
It was mostly concentrate based wines. So in his garage. But I think, you know, growing up, my dad's side of the family is Italian, and we've always had wine at our functions. Christmas, Thanksgiving were times that family got together. You know, my great uncle who lived in San Francisco, I was told stories later in my life that he made wine in his basement. So it's always, it's been kind of a theme in my family on the Italian side, but I would have to say I didn't grow up with wine always in front of me. So I just really loved science. I think starting in high school is when I really found a passion for science and knew that I wanted to get into a career that involved being outdoors and being involved with plants. So other universities that I applied to, I was looking at plant biology and courses of that nature. So when I found out about this, I was like, wow, couldn't be more perfect.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, that's incredible story so far. So the light bulb kind of goes off. You're already there at Davis. Yep. Take us through for where you started doing your first harvest, and then you made a couple stops along the way, it looks like, before you got to Maggie Hawk.
Yeah. So I graduated in 2001, and right out of college. So I have been fortunate enough to be married to my high school sweetheart. We both went to Davis, and upon graduation, we spent the summer and fall traveling to visit his family in first Peru and then Switzerland. We spent a month in each place. And that was pretty incredible, although I did miss the harvest. When I came back, I was looking for work, and I grew up in the South Bay Area, literally down the hill from Ridge Vineyards. And so I was applying at wineries. It was small family-owned wineries. I did land a job at a place called Cooper Garrod. It was half winery and half horse stable. And so I really got the intro to wearing many hats of a small winery. I was adding sulfur to the barrels for topping and sulfuring. They wanted me to run lab analysis. I was out in the vineyard pruning. And then on the weekends, I would work the tasting room. So I really got a sense of all that's involved in really running a winery, which was great. But it was very rustic, and I soon was looking to advance my career. So shortly thereafter, after, you know, spending a few months at Cooper Garrod, I got a job at St. Francis Winery in Sonoma Valley, where I was working in the lab. So I got to work in the lab for about, it was 8 months, and then I raised my hand to work in the cellar and get some experience. I really wanted to get my hands dirty, and I felt that was the way that I was going to learn the most, was just being totally immersed in it. And so while the lab was great, I really honed my technical skills in the lab. I wanted to balance that out with the practical application of what was happening in the cellar. And so I got to work on the reserve side of St. Francis Winery for a harvest, and that was really great. Under Lori Knapp, who was the head winemaker at the time. Tom Mackey was the winemaker there. Sally Johnson Bloom, who's the winemaker at Pride now. So I really was surrounded by a lot of great winemakers there. And mostly worked with Zinfandel, a lot of great historic Sonoma Valley Zinfandel vineyards we were sourcing from, Chardonnay, and Bordeaux varieties. So that was kind of my first real full-time job in the wine industry, was working for St. Francis, and that was for 4 years. I went back to the lab after that harvest and worked my way up to enologist / lab manager. And then after St. Francis, I moved over to Lambert Bridge Winery, which is in Dry Creek Valley. And there I was hired as the enologist. So going from St. Francis, which was very large scale production at the time, they were making 300,000 cases annually, to Lambert Bridge, which was 7,000 cases annually, and definitely higher end Bordeaux blends, some Zinfandel, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. So kind of staying on the Bordeaux side. And I stayed at Lambert Bridge for about 4 years, and Jill Davis was the head consulting winemaker. She was consulting, but she was really there full time, worked directly under her. And I feel like she mentored me really, really well. She included me on her trips to the vineyard. She was heavily involved in from the vineyard throughout the wine process, even at bottling. Very hands-on winemaker and very detail-oriented. And so I am grateful for what I learned under her tenure at Lambert Bridge. And I was still, you know, getting the technical side and the lab. But then she started including me on the vineyard side and the blending side. And so I think that's where I really started to get an appreciation for how incredibly artistic and hard it can be on that blending side, especially working with Bordeaux varieties and crafting these higher end Bordeaux blends really was a great experience.
That's great so far. Tell us about the where you went next.
Sure. So that was until 2010. And in 2009, I was pregnant with my son, had him, and was just learning how to navigate being a new mom. And really, the wine industry is a tough place for women who choose to become moms, because it's a very demanding career. And I was torn between wanting to spend time with my child and wanting to proceed in my career. And so I got a little bit burnt out and I wanted to step away. So I did, thinking that I would honestly never return back to the wine industry. I just was pretty burnt out and didn't see much opportunity for a work-life balance. And so I did leave Lambert Bridge, and then shortly thereafter, my really good friend, who's the winemaker at Artesa, her name's Anna Diogo Draper, approached me and said, "Have you heard about this? There's this nakedwines.com. I knew about them from when I was in Portugal, because she was born and raised there. They were big in Europe at the time, but they were making their way over to the U.S., specifically Sonoma Valley, California. And they were looking for winemakers to join and help build their business here." And so Anna and I applied. And it's kind of a funny story, because we applied based on the ad that we saw. You know, we agreed we wanted to make our own wine and pay for the grapes and start our own label. And we kind of thought that this would be it. We would pay them to essentially custom crush our fruit and store our wine. And so we submitted our resumes, and they called us in for an interview, and they said, "Do you know how this works?" And we're like, "Well, not really. Can you explain to us?" And they said, "Well, we're looking for 25 or so winemakers to join our team. You get to have full creative ability on the wines you're producing. We essentially sponsor you. We pay for the grapes. We pay for the staff to make the wines. You come in and you tell us how you want the wines made, and then we'll also sell them for you. And you get to have essentially your own label." So we kind of looked at each other. We're like, "That's crazy. That's too good to be true. No way." And we left, and shortly thereafter, you know, they contacted us. We found some grapes. We made a Cabernet Sauvignon, our very first vintage from Sonoma Valley. And we didn't believe it until, you know, the first kind of paycheck came in the mail, and we're like, "Wow, this is really for real. Like, this, we're getting paid to have our own label and make wines that we want to make." And so they just grew. They exploded. They did an excellent job, you know, marketing out to consumers, pitching the affordable, sponsoring the winemaker kind of angel investor concept, and it just exploded. And so the next year we pitched to them getting to make and focus on Portuguese varieties, which was kind of paying tribute to Anna's homeland. And I was totally keen on working with different varieties than I had previously worked with. So we sourced some Touriga and Tempranillo from Amador, and we started working with those. And got to do that for a few years. So that was a really fun little side project that I got to do. It was totally flexible. So, you know, I could still be a mom and make wine. It was a win-win all around. It was 2010. So right after I left Lambert Bridge, I was also, you know, kind of considering going back into the wine industry if it had to be the right fit. I had to still, you know, I didn't want to work the long hours during harvest. I wanted to be home with my child. And so I saw this ad for at Copan in on Eastside Road in Healdsburg, and I was intrigued. So I went and I interviewed with Wells Guthrie, and he basically said he needed somebody to deal with the things, the day-to-day that really, you know, no winemaker wants to deal with, which is like the 702 reports, the inventory, tracking of lab analysis, the organizational side. And so I said, yeah, sure. You know, I have the production background. I have experience with that. He said, you know, you don't have to work the long hours. You can come in at 9 and leave at 3. And so essentially it was a dream job for me and where I was in my point in my life, still getting to have a foot in the door and then come to find out, you know, more about Copan and Wells's approach to making Pinot Noir, Chardonnay and Syrah. I reinvigorated my passion for wine and the wine industry taking that job at Copan, because I saw how hands-off it was. He was, you know, the philosophy from the Burgundian producers and Northern Rhone producers of minimalist approach was just thrilling to me, coming from places that were so focused on, you know, inoculations and, you know, coopers, barrel coopers. You had to have many different barrel coopers, just very, very hands-on, very analytical at every stage of the wine's life, where at Copan, it was just the opposite. So that it was really refreshing to me to get to have that experience there and learn winemaking. Native wine fermentations was very new to me. Like seeing that at Copan, I was like, how could you just let it go like that? That's crazy. So it was great. And, you know, Wells would often open bottles of wine from all over the world. And so that's really, I think when you ask me, how did I get into wine? Well, I got into wine originally at UC Davis, but I would have to say I got into wine at Copan is when I first knew that there was a world of wine outside then of my little bubble in Sonoma County. So, yeah, it really ignited that passion.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. I think, you know, I want to get into the vineyards and get into the wines, but I think that's kind of a nice transition into just your winemaking style and the winemaking style of the wines of Maggie Hawk. I know they're different for each one, which we'll get into, mm-hmm. but just kind of the overarching philosophy. Usually I ask about things like picking decision, vineyard management, and then in the cellar, of course, things like use of oak. And you already mentioned like doing native fermentations or mm-hmm. different preferences there. And then there's things like whole cluster, those type of things. So I'd love you to kind of walk us through your philosophies there and kind of what you're trying to do with the wines at Maggie Hawk.
Sure. So 2017 was the first vintage that I started making the wines from Maggie Hawk. And when I first saw the vineyard, I was just, you know, kind of awestruck. It's such, I mean, a relatively small site. It's 58 acres in the far northwest corner of Anderson Valley, which we, you know, called the Deep End. And all planted to Pinot Noir. It's coming up on its 20th birthday here. So old vines, cool climate, Anderson Valley, just a really special place. And I guess the directive I was given was really these wines need to kind of translate the site, but also be incredibly different from each other. So each spring when I'm sitting down and looking at the four Pinot blends, That is my number one goal, is to make sure that I have four very different wines from one single site. And just briefly walking through them, we have the Jolie, which is translates in French to the pretty one. And that's meant to be an expression of more red fruit and higher acidity and less oak impact. That is typically predominantly 115 Clone Pinot Noir. The Unforgettable is a kind of what I've been calling the Goldilocks wine. It's not too black fruit or too red fruit. It's not too much oak or not enough oak, or high acid or low acid. It's like perfectly right down the middle. And I think that it's, if Jolie and Stormin were to have a child, this would be it. So that's my main goal, is to kind of make a wine that fits that profile for the Unforgettable. The Afflite is, that originally is called the whole cluster blend. So part of the winemaking approach at Maggie Hawk is, within this 58 acres, there are 15 different blocks of Pinot Noir, five different clones. We have 115, 777, 667, Vadensville, and just a tiny bit of Pommard. And I get little bits and pieces from all these sections. And when they come into the winery, I then also break it apart into a tank of destemmed fruit and a tank of some varying percentage of whole cluster inclusion. And they're fermented and aged separately. And so I have a lot of different little lots to consider when blending these wines. Now, for the Afflite, I only focus on the lots that have the whole cluster inclusion on them. So it's grown over the vintages. So I've increased the amount of whole cluster and decrease the amount of new oak, because my philosophy on that is that I feel like if I were to have new oak on the wine with whole cluster in it, it would just totally take away from that exercise. So I want to showcase the whole cluster. And so therefore it's living in neutral oak as of the 2020 vintage. And then the last wine in the Pinot lineup is Stormin, and that's meant to be the muscular, dark brooding. It's primarily 777 clone. That clone tends to hang on a little bit longer out in the deep end, and so it's harvested last, and it can handle a higher percentage of new French oak. And so that one typically is the bigger, bolder of the four Pinots, and so we pour it last in the lineup.
Yeah, that's a great intro to the Pinot lineup. You kind of alluded to it there, but I was going to ask just about clones. How people should think about clones as far as their influence on taste and body and different types of things like that.
Right, yeah. Clones are just essentially different expressions of Pinot Noir. And so, from my experience working with vineyards throughout California, it can really differentiate from site to site. Absolutely. And we're finding that more and more in Anderson Valley too, even though the valley is super small. There's such a differentiation between even the vineyards in the deep end and the vineyards that are closer to Boonville and the valley floor. So even though you have these same clones planted, the Pommard planted at Maggie Hawk is totally different than a Pommard clone that you would find in, say, Russian River Valley. Even within Russian River Valley, Green Valley on those Gold Ridge soils is totally different. So site, I think, plays a huge role in how these clones, and especially Pinot Noir, I think it's well known from winemakers that Pinot Noir is a pretty delicate, as far as grape varieties go, delicate grape, and it definitely shows its colors more than I would say Cab or Merlot does.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely a great explanation for listeners out there who are curious. Let's get into the white wines and the lineup that we're looking at here. And then you talked a little bit about Anderson Valley there. I want to get to that a little bit later too, and just talk about the area and what it's like living there and everything. But first, yeah, let's jump into the whites here.
Okay, so we have two whites for Maggie Hawk. The first is a white Pinot Noir. So it is a white wine made from a red grape. I source it from a single block and 115 clone from Maggie Hawk Vineyard. And we harvest it at night, whole cluster directly to the press. It sees no skin contact, which the juice turns out just the same color as a Chardonnay or other white wine. So we press it. A gentle press cycle. We use a Cremant program on our press, which is basically a very light, gradual pressure increase without any rotations of the drum of the press. And we get really terrible yields. It's like 100 gallons per ton. But we're looking for quality, not quantity here. So the juice is pressed to tank. And then the next day, we rack it down to 100% neutral French oak, where it carries out primary and secondary fermentation. And it ages for 9 months in those neutral barrels, and then we bottle it the following summer.
Then, wow, that one sounds just really interesting, because I bet a lot of people listening haven't heard of a white Pinot Noir. Do you ever get that from people?
Yes, all the time. They're like, a white wine. Yeah. They hear Pinot Noir, they think red, and then I pour it out of the bottle and they're confused. And I love that about this wine. I love getting reactions from people, and pleasant ones, hopefully. But they seem to, you know, start to warm up to it when I say it's, you know, very light, crisp. We do age it in oak, but you get no oak impact because we're using neutral barrels. And I would say that if you were to pour it in a dark colored glass, you would fool some people, because it does teeter the line between red and white fruit profiles. And so, you know, like watermelon rind or red plum, oftentimes it has. And then it also has the like ginger and stone fruit characteristics. So it is a really unique wine.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. Now, moving on to the Chardonnay.
So Skycrest Chardonnay, that is sourced from a different vineyard because Maggie Hawk is only planted to Pinot Noir. Although I think it would be an excellent spot to plant Chardonnay, we currently don't have it there. And so Skycrest Vineyard is further south. It's a high elevation spot just above the town of Boonville on the east ridge of Anderson Valley. And the blocks that I source from sit between 1,500 feet and 2,000 feet elevation. So very high up, super sandy soils. The vines, I think, do exceptionally well for that kind of environment. The Chardonnay, to me, just really holds its acidity so incredibly well. My desert island wine is Chablis, and so I guess I channel that. Not that I could ever replicate that here, but that's kind of the style. I think Chardonnay gets a really bad rap, and I guess one of my kind of secret missions is to get people to like Chardonnay again, because I know that there's some that, you know, pin it as the oaky, buttery wine, and it can be so many different things and not that. So this Chardonnay has just under 20% new French oak. It's aged for 15 months, the same time that my Pinot Noirs are aged. So given that length of time, and I think it needs it, and then an additional, you know, time in bottle before it's released. I love making Chardonnay.
No, this one is really delicious, crisp, like you said. It doesn't have those big buttery flavors as you alluded to there. So if someone looking for more of a Chablis type style Chardonnay, this is perfect for them. Let's get into a little bit, and you touched on it already, but the different vineyards that you have, the two vineyards. Mm-hmm. And then I'd love to hear just a little bit about what it's like working and living in Anderson Valley, and describe it a little bit for people who haven't been there. I've been lucky enough to drove from Napa all the way through Sonoma and all the way up through Anderson Valley to Mendocino, nice. Which was a really fun trip. Yeah. So I got to see a lot of that change in elevation and a lot of things along the way. One thing I remember about it is just the beautiful views in Anderson Valley, and then, you know, you're climbing up the hill, and once you're getting towards Mendocino, it becomes very, it gets cooler, and you have mm-hmm. The redwoods there, which are just yes. come really fast too. So maybe you could, yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, but I'd love to just hear what it's like living and working in the area and describe it for people.
Sure. So I actually don't live in Anderson Valley. I live in Santa Rosa, but I drive up there all the time.
Oh, okay.
But you know, working, I'm up there at least once a week, more during harvest.
Yeah.
And also because I'm the newly elected president to the Wine Growers Association. So I'm heavily involved up there. I love the community. The people are just amazing. And they care so deeply about the Anderson Valley. It's special to have been kind of an honorary community member and brought in. But working up there, it's peaceful. It's beautiful, like you said. When you drive in, when you initially drop in after you make it through that windy road on 128, you drop into the valley. In the town of Boonville. And on the left, you see a ridge that's just flooded with conifers. And on the right, you have a ridge that's more grasses and oak trees and madrones, rolling hills. And in the middle is the valley floor. So Anderson Valley is just only 15 miles wide by about a mile, or 15 miles long by 1 mile wide. So very condensed area, but incredibly exceptional growing region for Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and Alsatian varietals like Gewürztraminer and Riesling. So it's just a really epic place to make world-class wines. That's, you know, part of, a lot of us know that already. I think the word is starting to get out that this deserves to be on the world stage with everybody else. I think places like Roederer knew that back in the 80s. They, you know, found that it was just a stellar place to produce sparkling wines. And a handful of other producers like Navarro and Hanley, some of the pioneers in the valley. And so I encourage you to come up. It's, you know, just a couple hours north of San Francisco. But it feels like when you're there, it feels like you're in a whole nother world.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. Tell people how they can come visit you, interact, and be able to buy the wines and be able to taste what you talked through here with some of these beautiful tasting notes and wines that we discussed.
Sure. So currently we are in the process of getting a tasting room ready to open in the spring of 2022, hopefully just in time for the Winter White Wine Festival, which is, I think, the third weekend in February. So that tasting room is located in Philo, right next door to Domaine Anderson, across the street from Goldeneye Winery. So a very reputable neighborhood there. And in the meantime, if you wanted to get the latest allocation, just head over to maggiehawk.com and sign up. It's free to sign up for the allocation. You'll be first to know about the new releases. So we have two releases a year, one that just happened in the fall where you get the Chardonnay, the Jolie, and the Storm and Pinot Noirs. And then in the spring, the allocation is the White Pinot Noir, the Effete, and the Unforgettable. If you wanted to come taste right now, we have the wines available. We're part of a tasting room collection, the Spire Collection, and we have tasting rooms in Calistoga and in Chalk Hill. And so they have all of the Maggie Hawk wines there and available to taste.
Great. Well, thanks for the rundown there. This has been a lot of fun. We're going to link the website in the show notes. We'll link a couple other articles that I found on you and describing some of your winemaking history and things that you talked us through. This has been great. You know, what are you looking forward to right now as we're kind of going through harvest? Is that right?
Yeah.
Like maybe you could just kind of wrap up and tell us, you know, where you are in the process. I'm assuming the fruit is already in tank and everything at this point.
Yeah. So the 2019's getting on vintage variability. The 2019 vintage was pretty quick, but I would say this vintage is even quicker. It was more condensed and compact and early. I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that we had very little rain this year. So we were in drought conditions and really worried about whether we would have enough water to give the vines to carry them through full maturity. And so luckily we did. I started harvesting, oh gosh, when was that? It was, I think it was early September. Like, yeah, we're still in September. So September 9th, I know we brought in Chardonnay because that was my mom's birthday. And I finished a week later. Usually I like to spread the picking out over 2 weeks between the Chardonnay, White Pinot, and Pinot Noirs, but everything came in within a week. So just to put that into perspective. And it, you know, 2019 and 2021, I feel like have very similar characteristics of what I'm seeing so far. Incredible concentration in the 2021 vintage. We had smaller berries, smaller clusters, and that's just what I've seen so far in the mid-ferments here is just incredible color and already some good amount of extraction from the wines.
Well, that's great. There's a lot for people to look forward to then.
Yeah.
I encourage people to get on the mailing list. Like you said, look forward to the tasting room that's coming. And there's a lot to look forward to. And Sarah, wishing you the best for the rest of this harvest and into the new year.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks for joining us today. If you like the show, we encourage you to tell a friend. You can support the show by subscribing to our email newsletter for just $5 a month. Find it on our website at goldenwestpodcast.com. In it, you'll find unique bottles from both popular and undiscovered winemaking talent, among other things. If you have feedback, find us on Twitter, @GoldenWestPod, or you can email us at goldenwestpodcast@gmail.com. As a reminder, all opinions expressed by guests are solely their own and may or may not reflect the views of their employer or any other affiliated entity. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be used as a basis for investment decisions or any other advice. Please eat and drink responsibly, and thanks for listening.